This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 116. Brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Reza Ahmed, CEO and founder of Wise Alpha, to talk about investing in corporate bonds in the fintech age. Having a topic-based show, I feel increasingly like a collector of coins or stamps. Sellers approach me with a coin for sale, but rarely is it a coin I don't already have. However, there's always something unseen, or in this case unspoken, I guess. And one of the, if we stop to think about it for the moment, curious gaps in our collection is corporate bonds, which after all is an $11.7 trillion market worldwide, encompassing a huge range of credit quality and liquidity, all the way from AAA to some of the smaller, cruddier so-called mini bonds, which have appeared via equity crowdfunding platforms. So it's with great pleasure that I talk to Reza today, who is not only an advocate for the benefit of corporate bonds, but whose firm, Wise Alpha, enables you to invest in them for as little as £100. We'll hear about Wise Alpha's offerings later in the show, but for our main course today, we'll zoom in a little to the corporate bond market. Like all collective nouns, we can use it as objects. In fact, in the age of identity politics, plenty of narratives seem to pretend that collective nouns are either atomic or refer to a set of homogeneous phenomena. However, zooming into any collective noun, we find a complex set of subcategories, which it's important to know about if you're going to go and stick some of your money in them. 30 years ago, I was investing on behalf of clients from governments to ultra-high net worth individuals in government and corporate bonds, and so I'm fully acquainted with the fact that there A is value there, although in my day, doing anything other than investing in my unit trust was the only business model for accessing my wonderful services. But not only is there value there, of course, there's also risk there. We owned, in my department, some DFC, Development Finance Corporation of New Zealand short-term commercial paper, for example, which was rated AAA and guaranteed by the government of New Zealand. How safe can you get? Fortunately, this matured, but several months later, DFC New Zealand went bust. So I have personal experience that even AAA, let alone the issue of whether rating agencies are accurate or not, which we all saw in 2008, even AAA stuff can be risky. So, as always, there's a kind of search thing going on here. How do you find where the value lies and avoid the elephant traps? How do you access the market in a cost-effective way? How are these questions answered, not 30 years ago, but in the fintech age? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Reza. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be here.
So we were talking before about a kickoff, and I'm very pleased to say, and actually I didn't really ask my guests this very often, so it's a bit of a coincidence that I found out that in terms of your university career, you went to the prettiest college in Cambridge, which is by far the best.
I did indeed,
yes. Which I think we can agree on.
Yes, no, I did indeed. I went to Queen's College, Cambridge, which is one of the larger colleges at Cambridge. Beautiful, beautiful college. You know, a lot of greenery and some really antique buildings. Fantastic.
And all the best people went there.
They did indeed.
But I think actually what was said when I was there was, it is no longer true, which is that Queen's is the only college in Cambridge which has architecture from every century, from the 1400s to the 2000s.
I think that is actually true.
To the 1900s. Now, that was true. It's got something from the 15th century, 16th
yes,
century, 17th century,
right.
18th century, 19th century, and 20th century.
Yeah.
We're now in the 21st century, so I'm not sure it's got anything for the 21st century. Unless it's the extension of the ugly Cripps building.
That's right, yeah. No, they did some... There is a modern part of Queen's, which is obviously the least nicest part. I don't think they've built anything new since then.
No. It's interesting, as it were, that the older buildings are the best. That says quite a lot. And for people who weren't at Queen's College, history lasts a long time over here, so rents at Queen's were quite high compared to other richer colleges like Trinity, which owns half of the country. And this is because we got the Civil War wrong. We were on the wrong side in the Civil War, so we lost all our money. So the likes of you and I had to pay more room rent because literally centuries ago.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, my CEO, Tom, actually went to Trinity. And so, you know, they're very generous. Free rooms, the full service. But to be honest, I mean, everything's pretty subsidised. And I think when I was there, in the final year, you get to choose from the oldest rooms at Queen's, which are obviously the nicest.
Where were you?
Actually, unlucky. I went to Owlstone Croft, which is...
Oh, that's an outland bit, isn't it?
Well, that was my fourth year. I went to, what's the one in the corner? The one right in the corner, right at the end of the college.
It just shows that, so you were there about 20 years after me, so I've got an excuse for being a senile. You're just obviously an overworked fintech. Well, my last year, I was in Fisher Building, which people know is Silver Street, and I was right in the top corner. I had a fantastic view over the mill pond and all that kind of stuff from my set. And this back in the day, sort of 80 to 83, well, this was 1983, 80 to 83, and I used to see Stephen Hawking then in his little sort of motorised wheelchair going over the bridge to Dampt and Department of Applied Maths and Physics or something like that. And in terms of things being changed, I do think that in the past people were allowed to be more people as opposed to now being sort of corporate bods or PC or all this kind of nonsense. And we were talking about the fact that some of the stories from my day have made it to your day. And one of them was that one morning in, I think it was 82, 83, in Cripps Court, the ugliest court, everyone was awoken by the sound of lowing cattle because somebody had managed to get a herd of cattle into college, which is fantastic.
I heard that. That's a story that's been passed down over the generations.
Yes, now that is a jolly jape, isn't it? And another one was that the mathematical bridge, which is the pretty bridge going over the Cam, which allegedly is done by Newton, which wasn't. And it's the only way to get between the two parts of the college because it's on both banks of the Cam, was that after a lot of snow, some undergraduates managed to build a huge snowball and block it off. So a porter who was patrolling the far side then had to spend the night in chapel. So was there anything in your day, or was everybody sort of sitting there reading the FT worrying about their management consultant jobs from being a fresher?
I mean, there was obviously a few crazy things that happened, but not, I mean, I think those types of pranks were, you know, quite legendary, actually. But I think in my year, we're pretty sedate,
yes.
I would say, when it comes to those things.
It's all got very serious. My younger daughter's there at the moment. They just seem to focus on work and all that kind of stuff, which is unfortunate because you spend the rest of your life doing it. Now, talking about spending the rest of your life doing it, so after being there, what did you then decide to do to pay off all your, what presumably were by then student debts? Are student debts come in or was it?
Yeah, like most people, I had student loans. So, you know, the key thing was to try to find a well-paying job and, you know, in a profession that you kind of wanted to be in. So, you know, I studied economics actually, and then I took an interest in banking and finance. That was one of the courses I studied. So I applied to an investment bank. I joined Deutsche in early 2004. In M&A, and then I subsequently moved to the leveraged finance team and started to structure large loans and higher bonds for companies like Virgin Media and really got into that space. And hence, you know, that's kind of formed the rest of my career and obviously what we're doing with Wise Alpha as well.
And talking of the social aspect of life, in the sort of mid-noughties, what were the kind of hours for sort of the young cannon fodder such as yourself in terms of when did you on average turn up and when did you on average stay until?
Oh, in the banking days, I mean, I used to do all-nighters sometimes.
Oh, wow.
You know? Yeah. It was very much a work hard, play hard culture. It still is, to be honest. I think people who work in kind of banking and finance, they realize that in the first kind of few years, you know, it's all about how hard you can work and what you can do rather than, you know, trying to produce quality work, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, that's how it was. Maybe that still is the case.
Yes, it's all changed. Well, my elder is in the third year doing physics at UCL, and so she's graduating next summer.
She's selling her soul to go into finance as well, or?
Well, I think she's kind of doing what you did, which is that, I'll tell you what, I'll do another year of this studying law, just to be on the safe side kind of stuff. I'm kind of of the opinion that she won't go into physics, that she already knows far, far, far more about physics than she will need for the rest of her life, so that there's no need to learn any more physics. So I think it's a certain amount of kicking the can down the road. I did a thing called The World of Work Has Changed Forever on YouTube about sort of 7 years ago or something, saying that actually the world of work had changed from my day, and in my day there's a lot of middle ground, but these days you either basically work for what I call a giant factory, be it Slaughter and May, or be it Deutsche, or any of those, or you were kind of free-range chicken doing a sort of coffee shop or a Wise Alpha or something like that, and the middle ground has been hollowed out, because I kind of went into the quite a bit of the middle ground, actually. So she's kind of faced with this stark choice, but I think that the honest answer is that when you spent your entire sentient life in education and all that, to be honest, you don't really have a clue. I noticed when I was recruiting new graduates at Climewatts that the thing that new graduates want to do is always kind of ring the bell for the top of the market. That's the thing you shouldn't do, because it's about to crater, because they go, oh, you know, fintech's really hot, or something, they go into fintech, or management consultancy's really hot. So she's talking about doing good in the world, which, of course, is wonderful. I'm sort of trying to be paternal and say that doing good is fantastic, but actually, it's not so simple. You know, you join an NGO or a charity, you may or may not do good in the world. I mean, you're doing good in the world as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think so. I think what we're doing is trying to open up a market and, you know, give access, which, you know, I think when it's a high, when something's high quality, when something is worthwhile, giving access to it, opening up doors, that is a social good. So I do believe we are doing good in that respect. But it's interesting enough for you, you know, you're talking about your daughter deciding what she wants to do. But I think that it's always pretty rewarding for the first few years to kind of get experience of the corporate world, if that's the, you know, if you're looking to kind of, you know, develop businesses in the future before you go become an entrepreneur, because you get the experience, you grow up a lot, you know, you meet people who could help you on your way. So maybe that's something your daughter will think about. But or is she going to go straight into the entrepreneur world, set up her own business? Or,
well, I think that apart from the ultra rare exception, anyone would be mad to go straight into found my own business, never having worked in one.
So it worked for Branson, didn't it?
Exactly. He's an ultra rare example, and he's busy screwing the stage in the NHS now, which is very nice of him, having done it for the railways. But for the vast majority of people, they're better off either getting experience of the big corporates or of a small startup. You know, they're much better coming to work for you for 6 months or something as an intern, all that kind of thing, just to see how it is. And I'm very fortunate in my career in that I've worked for the huge ones, the medium-sized ones, the small ones, and the tiny ones. So you get a taste of what it's like. You get a taste of the experience. Anyway, going back to you doing good in the world. So corporate bonds then, I think most people have kind of heard of corporate bonds, but probably not many of the listeners will have had direct experience in the corporate bond market. So do you want to just give us a little bit of sort of brief background or history of what corporate bonds are sort of per se before we sort of start zooming into today? What is one, simply put?
A corporate bond is simply a loan which is given to a company by investors. And the biggest part of the corporate borrowing market is the bond market these days. So a lot of big companies like, you know, Ocado, Virgin Media, BT, so companies that people are familiar with, you know, go to the capital markets, and banks help them to go out to a large number of investors and say, hey, look, we're looking to raise a bond so we can finance X or invest in this network or, you know, buy this company. And investors will receive an interest rate in order for lending to the company. And that's effectively what a corporate bond is. Where it's come from has been quite an interesting kind of, history. If you think about bonds as a general concept, I mean, it started off in the 1700s, you know, with companies like, you know, banks like the Rothschild family lending to countries at higher interest rates, you know, if they wanted to finance wars or finance construction. And then I think really when the corporate bond market started to kind of build was probably in the kind of late 19th century, early 20th century, out in the States, when, you know, ratings agencies like Moody's were set up in 1909 to kind of assess the risk of a particular corporate. And, you know, a lot of low-grade bonds or high-grade bonds were kind of issued, so companies with varying degrees of risk. And I think over the 1900s to the 1950s, 1960s, there was a methodology created to kind of determine what that risk is. And so people found that they could, you know, lend in this market and earn interest rates of anywhere from kind of 2% upwards. But the majority of the people who were doing that were the wealthy and the banks who were providing that financing. And nothing has actually changed since the early, you know, 20th century.
And the interesting thing, going back to the 1900s in American railroads, because I was just writing about this recently, is that one reason that bonds were super popular then was that railroad founders in particular were very keen on keeping control of the company. So these are the days of trusts, you know, the sort of the Standard Oil was, you know, created JP Morgan, blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff, and huge railroads. So there was a limited amount of equity, so there's huge debt borrowings. Now, I've forgotten the statistic, but it was something like in the last 25 years of the 1800s, it was either one quarter or three quarters of all railroads went bust. It's a creation of huge infrastructure and huge losses. Okay, so that's the sort of the background, and as you say, in essence, it's a bit like, well, it is, it's a loan not directly involving the bank's balance sheet, and it has the benefit that it's tradable in the secondary
market. That's right, yeah.
Market. So, I've lent you a tenner, I want it back in 5 years' time, and that's what the bond says. You have a sort of sinking fund or amortized, but anyway, keeping it simple, you've got to give it back in 5 years' time, but I need money in 2 years,
yes,
and you haven't got it to pay me back, you don't wish to pay me back, so but I can give my piece of paper to someone else. I said, look, Razor owes you 20 quid, and he'll give it you in a year's time, and he's paying 5% interest rate. And look, and I'll sell you that for sort of 98p on the pound. And that's basically all it is, isn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, corporate bonds, you know, are very organized in terms of the way that they are sold, the way that they are tradable on a secondary market. If you think about kind of the mini bonds, which is the kind of, you know, private bonds which are issued in the kind of retail market, those aren't listed, they don't trade, and it's a very much a kind of bilateral type of lending basis between a company and a borrower. But the corporate bond world is, you know, very interesting, very unique, because there's a lot of things that you can think about when assessing corporate bonds. We can come on to that a bit later.
Yes, indeed. As you say, there's return and there's risk and there's also liquidity, because unless you're going to hold it to maturity, you might want to sell it. And the kind of spread, either bid-offer spread, is super important, as well as how much you can actually sort of sell without changing the price. So if we look at the sort of topology today, there's, I don't know how many dimensions of matrix there are, but given what I just said, there's credit rating, so you've got AAA to ZZZ.
Yep.
And then another dimension is how much they're paying in terms of return, and the other dimension, goodness knows how you measure it, is liquidity. So how do you, as somebody sort of up to your knees, as it were, in corporate bonds, how do you view the sort of topology of how that breaks down? I mean, and we can touch on sort of which bit of it Wise Alpha actually focuses on, and where, just in terms of listeners in general, where do you think value is, and how often does value move around? I mean, is it a question that we're recording this in October. In October, the value is in this part of the 3D matrix.
Yes.
But actually in November, it'll be somewhere completely different, or, you know, how long do these sort of anomalies, if you like, or value anomalies, how long do they sort of persist?
It's actually pretty interesting to note that the bond market is exceptionally varied. There are a whole different gamut and types of bonds that exist out there. And that's actually been driven by innovation in the bond market over the last kind of 20 years. But, you know, in the kind of media and in general life, think about the word bond. You know, they generally think about government bonds, which is kind of the oldest and most common form of bond that's existed, issued by governments. That's obviously a much lower risk market, and that's when, you know, people focus on whether they're AAA, AA. But the yields are obviously very low, and the bonds tend to be very long dated. So that's a very big segment of the bond market. Then you come on to the corporate bond market. So, and that, again, that those bonds are typically segmented in terms of risk. The most common and the largest segment of the corporate bond market is the investment grade market. So these are very high grade blue chip corporates that have very little risk.
And investment grade these days is,
that's actually BBB and above. So to be investment grade, you have to be at least BBB.
So 30 years ago, we only invested in AA- and above. So where you draw the line varies. But anyway, so the way the phrase is currently used, though, is BBB and above. And do you have any sort of statistic, and obviously this varies across the cycle, of, for the sake of argument, let's say I just pile $1 million into, well, let's just say I buy $1 each of $1 million bonds, what percentage of BBBs I can expect to go bust, roughly speaking? I mean, AAA is supposed to be roughly zero.
It's actually interesting. The default loss rates in kind of investment grade assets are extremely low. I mean, it's literally when you've got a case of, you know, fraud or something that was completely unforeseen, that's when you have an event of default. And so it normally ends up being just a few high profile cases, you know, over the course of a century. But that's not to say there isn't risk, but, you know, that's why the yields these days are kind of trading at kind of between 1 and 2%, 1-2.5% maximum.
Above governments, or in absolute?
In actual yield. You know, the interesting thing is actually that it depends how you think about this, but, you know, sometimes blue chip corporates, you know, ultra blue chip corporates, are actually viewed as a safer bet than
governments.
Governments, you know. So people would view Apple risk as lower than, you know, lending to Turkey, for example.
Well, I think Apple has more cash than the UK Treasury and Bank of England put together.
So exactly.
There is some argument around that. So on the credit ratings, then, we need to touch on, well, back in the day, we did not trust the credit rating agencies. We absolutely used them as some guide, but we also did our own credit analysis on top of it. But going back a decade, the credit rating agencies were spectacularly unsuccessful in the late noughties around 2008, and also they were spectacularly politically successful in avoiding being given a good kicking, unlike all sort of banks and insurance companies and all this kind of stuff. And that's a sort of a bit of a mystery. I've never quite found the answer to that one yet. So 10 years on from the I too often see is called the GFC, Great Financial Crisis Crash, or whatever it was. 10 years on, have the rating agencies reformed, and are their ratings, quotes, better than they were before, or will we not know until there's a 2028 crash?
I actually think that the 2008 crisis was actually a wake-up call for a lot of the market, including the ratings agencies, because I think, you know, what we'd seen up until then was like a golden period or a boom that had occurred for the last kind of 10 years. And so, you know, methodologies were kind of, people kind of got a bit lazy. But I think since then, there's definitely been a step up in the quality of ratings and the differentiation of risk. And actually, ratings agencies are now less worried about upsetting governments or large corporates by changing their ratings. Because at the end of the day, what it was all about was incentive alignments and where people were getting paid.
Show me the money.
Yeah. So people have been thinking very much more about their reputation since 2008. Regulators have also played a role into pushing banks to overcapitalize or increase their capitalization in some cases. And so I think that's reduced a lot of risk and created a little bit more sensible thinking when it comes to actually structuring bonds, for example, and assessing the credit risk. So people have generally increased the quality of their credit underwriting standards, I think. That's my view.
I'm sure that's the case. I mean, going back to, you mentioned sort of the 1700s or whatever, it's kicking off all that kind of stuff. And I've got sort of very jaundiced or tired of the narrative, which I've seen time and time and time again, which is that when there is a bad credit event,
yes,
everybody, banks, etc., tighten their credit quality. Yes. And you're not saying it, but people say, oh, no, this won't happen again because we've tightened it up, yada, yada, yada. And then what happens, of course, over time is that everybody, from investors and banks and corporates, they slightly take a little bit, they take a millionth of a percent more risk every day. And then over 10 years later, it's, you know, and also the generation changes, you know. So in a bank or in the bond department, loads of people get sacked, fired, disappear, new graduates join, 10 years later, everything's gone fine, what could possibly go wrong? And so this cycle has replayed over and over and over through history, which is just the credit cycle.
Markets do, you know, good boom and bust, and they, you know, in the corporate bond market, you often find that in heated markets, you know, things like covenants or protections for investors tend to get whittled down. Like you said, new generations come in and they forget, you know, some of the old things. But in general, I think, you know, we're in a better place than we were back in 2008. The other thing that's very important to kind of outline is that back in 2008, when the financial crisis hit, the issue was really much more concentrated in the mortgage market, you know,
yes,
in the US.
Yes, which is a structured deal, and I've never trusted structured deals by and large, and that has been an extremely good rule of thumb. And a structured deal is very different from Apple lends a bond, and it's Apple.
Yes, and I'll tell you where most, because, you know, I read up a lot about financial crises while I was studying at Cambridge, and a lot of the major crises that we've seen, you know, since the 1998 Asian crisis, you know, the 2008 crisis, has really been to do with when people are lending to unsophisticated borrowers, you know. So in the case of the US, it was borrowers who just didn't have the ability to pay, didn't really understand how to pay back their loans.
Who had been deliberately encouraged by the system.
Yeah, being encouraged by
democratization of mortgages. And
predatory lenders who were kind of allowing people to kind of lie on their, you know, their application forms. But I think the other interesting thing is that, you know, what were the roles of the banks, you know, in that type of situation? And that whole kind of slicing and dicing with the structured vehicles, that kind of exacerbated everything. Because it made a bad situation even worse, made it even more opaque. But if we go back to the corporate bond market, which is the area that we're focused on, that's much more of a vanilla product. It's a straight, you know, you've got a straight one-for-one investment in a bond with a company. And actually, since the financial crisis, the corporate bond and the corporate loan market is actually one of the strongest areas of the overall debt markets globally. That actually not only had lower losses during the financial crisis and in the next coming years, but it's also the area where there's been the biggest growth, because lending to corporates tends to be a much more sophisticated affair with accountants, lawyers, bank underwriting committees. And so, you know, it's not a contractual decision between an individual borrower and a bank or a lender. And so actually, a lot of the cohort of even the structured vehicles, which invested in loans and bonds during 2007, 2008, even with huge amounts of leverage, all of those things actually made money, you know, despite the crisis. So the corporate lending market is probably the most robust area of the overall debt market, and is actually the one which has seen the most innovation. So from 2007 to June 2018, the corporate bond market has actually grown 2.7 times. So
wow.
It's now an 11.7 trillion market. And the different types of corporate bonds that have been available or that have been issued has also increased. So what you've seen since 2008 onwards is a lot of issuance by banks of perpetual bonds or COCOs or other types of contingent capital instruments, which are actually an interesting product, because a lot of these things were structured at rates of between kind of 8 and 14% post the financial crisis, and were giving equity-like returns. And that whole market segment of the market has performed very, very well.
Yes. Okay, well, let's not get sidetracked into perpetuals, because it takes me back to horror, which is that I was asked to resolve a dispute within Carmel Benton senior management over the valuation of their perpetual. There were a group of people who said it's the cheapest thing we ever did and we should keep it, and the group of people who said we could capture the premium and sell it back, and that's actually what set off the whole sort of risk thing in the 90s. So putting Rinkydinks to one side, I hear what you say, which is that the corporate bond market has actually performed extremely well over 2008 and all that kind of stuff, and unsurprisingly it was a funny sort of structure and stuff, because actually it's not that hard to rate, frankly, Apple or Virgin Media for the sake of argument, and they've got balance sheets and all that kind of thing, as opposed to Rinkydink structures. So I read an interesting article of yours, just in passing, about the comparison of corporate bonds and the peer-to-peer market. What are the main takeaways from your position on corporate bonds versus peer-to-peer?
Well, I guess when we look at both markets, we see that right now the yields that, for example, that we're offering in our site are pretty much the same or higher versus some of the mainstream peer-to-peer lenders, which is incredible, because you know, you can lend to somebody like Virgin Media and you can make 5.5%, but you could go to a consumer peer-to-peer lender and receive a lot less. Some corporate bonds are actually even trading at kind of 10 to 12% yields. And so I find it quite striking that, you know, the quality of borrowers is much higher in the corporate bond market than in the peer-to-peer market. And the different industries are much more varied. And so that's why I think the corporate bond market is a lot more interesting. The other thing I would say is that the corporate bond market is much more established. So there are specific rules about how bonds are held in custody. There is a lot of due diligence carried out during the structuring phase of bonds, lawyers and accountants, there are strict underwriting committees at banks. And that is an established process which has been ingrained and built over the last kind of 40 years, which hasn't yet developed in the peer-to-peer market, which is still an evolving asset class from a regulatory perspective. So we think there's obviously clearly less risk for investors to dabble in this area of the market than peer-to-peer.
It's interesting, and it's very original content, which is that I haven't seen it before, comparing, as you say, the yields from Virgin Media compared to, shall we say, unsecured consumer debt.
Yeah.
And I do remember a little bit about what I used to do, and other things being equal, I'd probably rather take a risk on a firm like Virgin Media than some unsecured consumer debt. Although unsecured consumer debt has performed well over time, and make your own mind up, boys and girls listening. But in terms of trying to, quote, outperform the market, you do use this alpha word in your wise alpha, then one of the predominant ways of doing it over time has always been, mixing my metaphors, to fish in a pond that's got more fish in, that's got better value, is the main thing. So very briefly then, because we'll come on to wise alpha in a moment when you're wrapping up and tell us about what you do. So let's say people listen to this. Let's say they go away and do tons of research, consult their all advisors and all that kind of PC stuff they need to do, yada, yada, yada. And they go, oh, I've never really considered corporate bonds, but I think there's a very interesting investment. How do they get their money into corporate bonds these days? Do they go along to their stockbroker and, you know, if let's say they haven't got $1 million to spend, how do you get some of these?
Yeah, so this is the big dichotomy in the market right now. While the corporate bond market has been growing so rapidly and strongly, the fact is you today, as an individual, a private investor in the retail market, you have to try and find a fund that can give you exposure to that asset class, rather than being able to choose and effectively stock pick bonds on an individual basis, because there is no exchange for bonds. Having said that, there is a small selection on the London Orb, you know, which are typically kind of low yielding bonds issued by, you know, financial institutions. But the whole broad array of bonds that are issued that tend to be in the institutional market.
At the top end and the lower end is the mini bonds on an equity crowdfunding site. And you go along and you buy some mini bond and you have to sit on it forever and hope that the sort of dodgy vehicle doesn't fall over.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, those types of product is something that we steer clear of. It's obviously a lot more risk, it's more opaque. But in terms of the really high quality corporate end of the market, that is controlled very much by the 10 largest banks and about 150 big funds globally. Now, what we are doing is at Wise Alpha is actually breaking that stranglehold. So now people can get individual exposure to choose that and build their own portfolio of bonds in the larger institutional bond market.
So it's this old world of democratization.
It is, indeed.
Until a regulator comes along and says democratization is only for the rich, the wealthy and the party members and not for the plebs, but let's not go down that one for the moment. Okay, Dick, so in terms of all this, and maybe we'll come on to it in terms of you tell us a little bit about Wise Alpha. There's obviously a question of risk, and obviously the sensible thing is to diversify. Don't stick all your money on one horse or one corporate bond in case there is some disaster. There's also a question of fees, and without leaping forward to that one, the fact that you're offering people corporate bonds minus whatever your fees are at higher than peer-to-peer minus whatever their fees are. And I think this is one thing that's not particularly focused on so much in peer-to-peer, which is that they do take a nice chunk out of the middle. Yeah. And one of the ideas behind peer-to-peer was that they'd be so much, quotes, more efficient than banks, but they may or may not be more efficient than banks, but they certainly take a good chunk out the middle. So before we get round to talking about Wise Alpha and wrapping up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I wonder how many of you have been involved in corporate bonds. I guess probably not so many in terms of the direct exposures, you say, because you can't really do that unless you're an institution, apart from the likes of Wise Alpha turning up and allowing people to do it in small size. And I'd like to thank my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So that's the corporate bond market. I think it's a sort of fairly straightforward thing. I think, you know, the one thing that sort of the pennies landed a bit with me, which is in terms of the poor performance of the rating agencies, in my own mind, not paying any attention to it very much really, but insufficiently differentiated in 2008 between all these stupid structures, CDO squared, yardy, yardy, yardies, where the rating agencies had really cocked up, and the corporate market, where actually they performed far better. Mm-hmm. So we've mentioned Wise Alpha just a little bit, but let's just sort of briefly explain to the listeners what your model is and who you're open for and who should check you out if they're interested to invest their millions or their pensions or their tiny £100 spare money they've got after working all night at Deutsche Bank and the likes.
Absolutely. I mean, so we're very much a fixed income focused platform. So our focus is on corporate bonds. And the variety of bonds that we include on our marketplace, which people can choose from, range from investment-grade bonds, which might yield 2% to 3%, all the way up to high-yield or unsecured bonds, which are higher risk, but obviously much more rewarding, which could even earn you upwards of 11% onwards. So we have a very wide range, and you know, if people look at our marketplace, they can see that all of the companies that we have listed are really corporate. So they're, you know, at least 1 billion valued firms. These are real serious businesses. A lot of businesses that you will recognize, you'll buy the products from, you know, everything from Ocado, AA, RAC, Virgin Media, all the way to even borrowers in the consumer lending market.
And what range of maturities?
All the way from 3 years to some of the investment grade bonds tend to be quite long dated, 20, 30 years. But most of the bonds on our site tend to be, you know, on average 5 to 7 year maturities.
Okay, and so you've mentioned that from a tiny sum of money, like £100, somebody can go to your site and invest in a corporate bond. And you mentioned kind of listing. I don't know whether you used the word listing, but something like that.
Yes.
So how do you do that then? Because do you sort of have you bought a load of company bonds that are sort of sitting in a desk in your office, and when someone comes and asks £100, you sort of tear a tiny bit off and give it to them? How do the mechanics work?
Actually, that's right. So we almost like a wholesaler. So we buy in the large chunks that the banks sell, you know, to institutional investors, the 100K, 200K kind of minimum sizes. And we break those into small pieces and sell those to investors on the site. So you can get effectively exposure to a Virgin Media bond from as little as £100 effectively.
Right. So you have to run, well, it depends on the stage of your business, of course, but you have to run sort of quite some inventory, and you've got a cost mm-hmm. of carry yourself and all that kind of stuff, and your capital is tied up presumably in these corporate bonds. Just like Tesco's, for the sake of argument, they buy loads of loo rolls and sit on them.
Except the difference here is that we earn income from the underlying bonds while we hold them. And so we have the capital to do that and to create variety on our site as our business.
And I think at first I kind of slightly mistaken you for a fund manager, and I was about to sort of play my usual tape, which is digital fund managers are all fantastic and it's a great idea and it's more accessible and they're prettier and yardy, 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 but they're still charge the same old bloody fees as the old sort of bricks and mortar businesses do. I'll just get bored of saying that. I mean, it happens to be a true critique. So how do your fees work then? And I was about to say, how do they compare to the existing alternatives? But if the existing alternatives are unit trusts or fund managers or investment trusts, because there isn't nobody else who's doing what you're doing, selling little segments, you can easily say you're the best because there's no one else doing it.
That is true, yes.
And therefore a 20% fee is sort of very modest.
So we charge a 1% annual servicing fee. We also have a 0.25% sales fee. So that effectively covers our cost of holding the bonds in custody.
And when you say you hold them, you don't actually hold them, do you?
No. So we use Bank of New York Mellon, for example, BNP Paribas, who are two large bond custodians, to do that. And we obviously pay them.
So if I invest my money in you and you guys get hit by a meteorite, which sort of destroys you completely and all your computers, yes, I don't lose my bonds because they're somewhere else.
That's exactly right. Yeah. The bonds will continue to be serviced and interest paid out to investors.
So you're a bit like it's probably the wrong word, but you're a bit like a stockbroker. You organise it all, but actually you're not sort of sitting on my stuff.
Yeah, we're actually a little bit more than that, in that we're also the market as well. So if you think about, you know, the London Stock Exchange, you know, there's an exchange where people can buy and sell. That's us as well, in a kind of rudimentary form, at kind of very simple level. But we're also the broker, in that brokers will connect into an exchange, and we're the only, obviously, outlet where people can come to. So it's almost like people are coming direct to the exchange, effectively.
Okay, so I stick my 100 quid in. I'm not going to stick it with Virgin Media. I can't stand the people. They've put my fees up about 15 times in the last 2 years. I'm talking about an oligopoly, but not them. Anyway, Ocado. They're nice, aren't they? I put my 100 quid in an Ocado bond, and then in 6 months' time, I need my 100 pounds, so I can actually relist my bond with you? How does that
work? Yes, that's right. You can create a sell order on our market, and if another user wants to buy it from you, they will do so. And you can get liquidity that way.
So you're the market as well.
That's
and
right.
In terms of fees and all this kind of stuff, I have this sort of strange idea that sort of digital means that everything can be a millionth of a percent at some point in time. And you mentioned this sort of the annual servicing fee of 1%. So how does that work then? Is this sort of a bit like socialism is a sort of temporary thing on the way to sort of communism, and one day the Soviet Union will get it right after 1,000 years and your fees will be a millionth of a percent? Or where does 1% come from?
We actually look at some of the alternatives that we see in the market. I mean, we see a lot of lending platforms, like in the peer-to-peer world, either charging that type of servicing fee, but they also tend to earn a higher rate of interest from the borrowers directly, and then they pay a lower rate of interest to individual users. And we think about net rate of interest that people get from the overall experience on the site, and that's how we think about the rate. And we also consider how much wealth managers charge. You know, so the average wealth manager can charge, you know, anywhere from, you know, 1% upwards. Even the digital wealth managers these days, you know, even the kind of, you know, who are espousing the benefits of technology are still upwards of 1%. So that's where we're placed. I mean, obviously, over time, we want to build the firm and build the volume and build access. And so, you know, my interest is reducing, you know, the cost over time with scale. So we'll obviously pass some of that on to consumers.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we've touched on this before on the show, that sort of zeitgeist these days is that people like you need to build a sustainable long-term business, and as you get bigger and more efficient, then can be made better value for all concerned. And from my perspective, it's a fairly simple one, which is that if people do things digitally, and you're interesting because you're doing something different, so that's innovative, but if you're just being a sort of fund manager online and you're going to charge the old school prices, well, you've got a marginal benefit in that it's easier to do things on your phone and you've got a nice app and all that kind of stuff, and that's fine, but you're not absolutely going to blow up the bricks and mortar businesses by charging the same fees that they do. However, all the digital wealth managers, I'm not going to use the robo-advisor word, all the digital wealth managers have got some chance of blowing up the old-fashioned investment management industry if they can charge 1/100th of the price and deliver you a better performance because actually the fees are just smaller. So we'll see how that one goes over time. Just to wrap up then, so who can actually access your platform, Reza, and where are you going in the future?
So we have quite a broad access point in that every type of individual can actually access our
from the
platform.
UK or from Papua New Guinea or?
Well, so yes, apart from specific jurisdictions like the US and Japan, where there are restrictions on the investors being able to invest abroad. But it's pretty broad access, yes. So you can come from Europe, you can be in the UK, but the point is at the moment we're only offering sterling investments. In a few weeks, we will be offering European investments as well. In the future, we also are about to release our robo management tool, which is actually pretty interesting.
Does that mean I shouldn't have been rude about robo advisors?
Well, it's actually a slightly more interesting concept, I think, in that rather than having to be worried about picking your own bonds and building your own portfolio, you can let our RoboWise automated investing service handle that for you. So it will intelligently diversify your portfolio, it will make sure your cash is reinvested efficiently, and the most important thing about the tool is that you can see exactly what is going on all the time, and you can turn it on and off, which is very different to a kind of black box robo-advisor. So that's, I think, how we're more unique.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like a really useful tool. I think my aversion is simply to this sort of Americanized hype, the use of the word robo. It just seems like a useful auto-diversification and performance monitoring, blah, blah, blah. I don't think there's anything robo about it. But anyway, that's just my prejudice. The listeners are bored of me banging on about how there's no real robots there at all. Mind you, actually, I saw one of those. What are those people who build fantastic robots? The ones that can sort of run with a backpack, doing a flip in the air, actually.
Yeah.
So they're real robos. You know, just give them a gun and be up to a robo. Good. Okay, well, that's very interesting. I can't actually remember what the fees were on my Eurobond fund back in the day, which did have a fantastic performance, actually, but it would have been sort of similar order of magnitude, or maybe even more. And I think that it's really interesting, as I said at the beginning, to come across a firm such as Wise Alpha, who are doing something different and are enabling, whilst the regulators allow it, normal people to get into markets which historically have literally just been the preserve of institutions or the super wealthy. As always, caveat emptor, blah, blah, blah. But it's definitely an interesting concept. And with your background in the market, you're well placed to provide it. And I wish you every success in the future.
Well, that's great, Mike. Thanks very much for having me. And I was very happy to give an overview of the bond market.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.